Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
On the 29th of March, 1516, the Venetian Senate decreed that the entire Jewish community of Venice, as well as any Jews who subsequently arrived, be segregated to their own quarter, a quarter that became known as the Jewish Ghetto. Despite a restriction on movement and home ownership, despite segregation, higher taxes, and an increase of at least a third above the rental price given to a Christian, the ghetto became a haven, a flourishing place for the Jewish cultural renaissance. Among the notable men and women living there were the poet Sara Kopyeh Solam, the philosopher Leone Abreu, the musician Christian Talmudist, and Elijah Halfon, who became an advisor to Henry VIII. We might then ask, why does the fictional Shylock, avaricious moneylender immortalised in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, remain the most famous Jew of early modern Venice? How do we go about restoring these remarkable stories to Venice's history? Joining me to discuss these questions, among others, is Harry Friedman, author of a new book, Shylock's Venice, The Remarkable History of Venice's Jews and the Ghetto. Harry, welcome to Not Just the Tudors.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, Susanna.
To start, could you briefly set the scene for us in terms of what was happening in Venice as well as Europe more widely that caused the Venetian government at this time to construct the world's first ghetto?
Let me go back very briefly, 200 years, to the Black Plague in Germany. And the blame is being put on the Jews in Germany for starting the plague. That's quite common in those days. And they flee from Germany, they flee down into northern Italy. And they end up in Milan and around Venice. But the Venetians won't let them into the city of Venice itself. They tell them they have to stay on the mainland. Now, in those days, Jews are restricted from most trades. There are very, very few things they can do. The only profession they can do is medicine. They can be doctors, but that's all. And in terms of any other trade, they can't do anything agricultural. They can't own land. They can lend money because the church forbids Christians from lending money. And although Christians do lend money, they do it at very exorbitant rates because they're going against the church. So the Jews are allowed to lend money, and they basically become not so much moneylenders as pawnbrokers. There is this sort of idea of wealthy Jewish moneylenders, and they're well one or two, but the majority of them are pawnbrokers, and they're really giving what I would call payday loans to people who just need a few coppers to tide them over for a week until they get their wages. The Jews are living, and we're now coming up to the end of the 15th century, they're living in the Venetian territories on the mainland, and the nearest point where they live is the town of Mestre, which is just across the lagoon from Venice. And they're allowed to come into Venice for 15 days at a time, but that's all, to do their business. Then they've got to go again. And they have to wear a yellow badge to distinguish themselves as Jews. And until 1496, that's what the situation was. In 1496, the Venetians decide that the Jews are overdoing their privileges. They're covering up their badges and they're staying in the city for longer. So they make them wear a yellow hat instead of a yellow badge. They say they can only stay in the city for 15 days a year rather than 15 days consecutively. But, they say, if your lives are ever in danger, you can come into the city. 1509, the League of Cambrai, which is a coalition of European forces, the Pope, the Holy Roman Emperor, the King of France, decide that the Venetians are too rich, too powerful, and they invade the Venetian territories. There is a Jewish historian, or young man actually, a young man who's a student who decides to write a history of Venice, and he's in Padua as these armies approach, and he sees what's happening, and he writes an account of how everybody flees. They all flee to Mestre, and from Mestre, the Jews cross the lagoon and end up in Venice to save their lives. In 1509, that's the first time Jews are living in Venice. The Venetians, they're a mercantile economy, they're very mercenary, and they decide that they want the Jews to stay there. It suits them for the Jews to stay there because now people don't have to cross the lagoon to pawn their goods. The Jews who are holding all the pledges, all the deposits people have made, are in the city, not across the lagoon. So it makes more sense for them to stay there. And there's a commercial opportunity for the Venetians because they can tax them. And the way that taxes worked in those days was you taxed whole communities, not individuals. And the community was responsible for raising the tax amongst itself. So in 1511, for the first time, the Jews are living officially in Venice. They're being taxed 11,000 ducats a year. That's at a time when somebody might earn one ducat a week. A house will cost 25 ducats a year to rent. So it's a lot of money. And that amount is being shared out amongst the Jews of Venice, who probably number maybe 1,000, something like that. That goes on until 1516. In those 5 years, between 1511 and 1516, the Venetian authorities, and particularly the church, start to become offended by the presence of Jews. They don't want to come out of the house and see Jews living there. There is one very wealthy Jew, a man called Vita del Banco, Vita of the Bank, who is a wealthy man who's rented a palazzo on one of the canals. You know, they don't like this. So there's a lot of toing and froing in the Venetian Senate, and eventually they decide to move them into a ghetto so they can keep them in the city, but keep them out of sight. 1516 is when they move into the ghetto. The Senate tells all the Christians who are living in the area of the ghetto to move out. The Jews have to move in. The landlords are told they can charge one third more rent because they've now got to have Jews living there. And that's the beginning of the ghetto.
So we shouldn't conceive of a golden age of integration prior to the construction of the ghetto then?
Not in Venice. In Spain, yes, but not in Venice, yes.
So can you describe some of the practicalities of the ghetto, how large a place it was, where it was situated, and how many people live there? You said there were perhaps 1,000 Jews.
Yeah. So the ghetto is still there. If you go to Venice, you can see it. It's on the canal on the north. It is basically a square, four rows of houses surrounding a campo, a field, which is, I suppose, the size of a football pitch at the most, probably a bit smaller, the width of a football pitch squared. And it's not paved. It's muddy. It's insanitary. There are three wells. It's a horrible place. There's no sewage. It's a horrible, squalid slum. And the number of Jews who live there fluctuates, probably about 1,000 at the beginning, but the numbers go up and down, largely due to plague, but also due to a little bit of immigration when it's allowed. The houses are very narrow, and because they couldn't spread out, because the ghetto is defined by the canals and a wall, which where there's no canal, and gates, which are locked at night. So because the Jews can't spread out, as numbers increase, they have to go up. And they build the houses higher and higher, and they make the rooms narrower and narrower, and the ceilings lower and lower to get more and more rooms in. And it's standing on very watery subsoil, because it's Venice. And it's not just a dirty, horrible place to live, it's also a very dangerous place to live because the houses are so tottery. So that's what it looks like. They're allowed out during the day, and Venetians are allowed into the ghetto during the day, and they do this for trade because this is where the pawnbrokers are and the Venetians are coming in. That's how it starts anyway. The Venetians can come in during the day, the Jews can go out into the town. The gates are locked at night. There are four sentries posted on the gates, and the Jews are responsible for paying their wages. The original plan was to have a boat patrolling the canals at night, but it actually never happened. A lot of what the Venetians decided to do, they didn't do. They weren't that efficient at putting their plans into practice. But that's basically what it was, a squalid slum with far too many people in it for what it could contain.
So was it possible in these deeply constrained circumstances to establish any kind of financial stability?
Well, that's the official version. In fact, we know there's much more than that. There is, for example, there's a man called Moses del Castello, who is a very renowned artist. There's Sara Coppia Sulam, who is one of Italy's most famous early modern poets. So there are people who are breaking out from the constraints, if you like. And of course, the ghetto itself is almost a self-sustaining economy. So if you go into the ghetto, you'll find good weather. The stores are out in the campo, in the bad weather there in the ground floor of the houses. You'll find people who are, you know, you find bakers or people selling groceries, coifs they can sell and veils and things like that. So there are a number of things they're allowed to sell. But you get the impression the whole time that the people in the ghetto are pushing the boundaries. Because they're so restricted, they're not afraid to do more than they're supposed to do and hope they get away with it.
So you've given some sense of the restrictions on freedom of movement, for example, and indeed on employment, but some of the ways that that's being pushed at because the limits are so extreme that there is no alternative but to do that. Did they have religious freedom? Were they free to practice?
Oh, no, I don't think so. It's difficult to understand how this works. Apart from the ghetto, you've got Jewish merchants who are trading between Turkey and Venice. One of the reasons why the Venetians wanted to keep the Jews inside the ghetto once they came in was that Vasco da Gama had found a route to India round South Africa and was taking away a lot of the trade because people bringing spices and silks and things from India previously had to cross the Arabian Desert, a dangerous, slow process, get on a boat at Istanbul or Alexandria or somewhere and come across the Mediterranean to Venice. Venice was a major Mediterranean shipping power and trading power. And the Portuguese, when Vasco da Gama found his route, basically took a lot of that trade away from them. So the Venetians are desperate to rebuild their economy. And this is round about the same time as the Jews are fleeing into Venice. The Venetians want to have the Jewish merchants there. They don't particularly want the Jewish poor, but they want the Jewish merchants. So you have this small group of fairly wealthy merchants who maybe living in Turkey and coming across with their boats to Venice or the other way around. I mean, this is the merchant of Venice. This is what Antonio is doing. You have those people, and they obviously have some money. The ordinary people, they're totally impoverished. I mentioned the Del Banco family, Vito Del Banco and his wealthy and more famous brother, Anselmo. They've somehow, over generations, managed to turn themselves from pawnbrokers into wealthy bankers, but they are a very, very small group. Financial stability is the least of the Venetian ghetto population's worries.
So you've given some sense of the restrictions on freedom of movement, for example, and indeed on employment, but some of the ways that that's being pushed at because the limits are so extreme that there is no alternative but to do that. Yeah. Did they have religious freedom? Were they free to practice?
They were free to practice their religion, but initially they weren't allowed to build any synagogues. Now, that's not as severe as it sounds. For Christians, that's severe because Christians need churches. Jews don't need synagogues. They just need a space. So they could congregate in rooms and pray. And eventually, they do build synagogues. By the end, there were 5 synagogues in Venice. But the whole process of the ghetto existence is that every 5 years, their charter comes up for renewal. And every 5 years, the amount of tax they pay is increased or decreased. And the privileges they have are added to or taken away. And one of the privileges that gradually came was the opportunity to build more and more synagogues. So they've got religious freedom. Unlike Rome, in the Roman ghetto, the Jewish inhabitants of the Roman ghetto are forced to hear once a year a conversionary sermon. They're forced to go into a church and hear somebody, usually a converted Jew, preaching Christianity to them. That doesn't happen in Venice. Venice is a much more laid-back environment. And in fact, Venice's own relationship with Rome is much more distant than one might imagine. There's no Inquisition in Venice for a long time. And when the Inquisition does finally get permission to set itself up in Venice, the Senate lays conditions down. It tells the Inquisition that they must have a couple of senators on the board. They pay lip service to Rome, but they're not obliged to Rome in the same way. So the Jews are living fairly free lives, and the Jews are also not troubled by the Inquisition. They're only troubled by the Inquisition if they are what's called Judaizing, which basically means trying to persuade people to become Jews. And if they do that, then the Inquisition comes down on them, but otherwise they're left alone.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The restrictions on them, did it extend to Venetians entering the quarter?
No, so Venetians can come in. Venetians can come in only during the day because the gates are locked at night. Venetians can come in, and not only can they come in, but they do come in. And this is one of the fascinating things. There is a decree issued by the Senate at one point in the early 16th century forbidding the Christians to go to a play that the Jews are putting on, the Festival of Purim, which is the carnival festival, where you have a play every year. And the Senate is forbidding the Christians to go. Why are they forbidding the Christians to go? Because they're going. Otherwise, they wouldn't need to forbid them. And there's a diarist called Marin Sanudo, a Venetian diarist, who says, we've been forbidden to go to see this play, but actually it was very good. Clearly they went in. And more than that, the most famous resident of the ghetto, I suppose, is a rabbi called Leon Modena, or Leon of Modena. He's a well-reputed rabbi. He has friars and Christian nobles coming into the synagogues when he's preaching. His reputation is such that the sermons they're going to hear there are better than the sermons they would hear in the churches. So they're coming into the ghetto to hear him preach. So clearly the Christians are coming in. And the most famous example of this is when Henry VIII sends an envoy to Venice. Henry VIII, as we know, was trying to divorce Catherine of Aragon. He's trying to get rid of her by any means. And his bishop, John Stokesley, tells him that he should never have married Catherine because Catherine was married to his brother. And it says in Leviticus that you can't marry your brother's wife or your brother's widow. So Henry says, great. But the Pope says, no, but it says in Deuteronomy that if your brother dies childless, then you are obliged to marry his widow. And Arthur had died childless. So Henry's caught the horns of this dilemma. Does the Bible permit me to marry her or not? Is the marriage valid or not? And the only way he can get an answer to that is to send an envoy to Venice, where he sends a man called Richard Croke. And Richard Croke goes to Venice and he meets Friar Francesco Giorgi, who's one of the great Kabbalists and mystical thinkers of the time. And Giorgi lives in Venice and has friends, in Jewish friends, in the ghetto. So clearly they're coming backwards and forwards. So Giorgi takes Richard Croke into the ghetto and introduces him to a man called Elijah Halfon, who's a rabbi, a Kabbalist. And Croke explains the situation and Halfon says, this is ridiculous. Of course, he's not obliged to marry his brother's widow. That only applies to Jews. So Croke says, great. But Halfon has an enemy or a rival in the ghetto, a man called Jacob Mantino. I didn't tell you, Halfon is a doctor as well as a rabbi. And Mantino is a doctor and a rabbi. And Mantino happens to be a friend of the Pope. So the Pope asks Mantino what he thinks about Halfon's ruling, and Mantino says he's completely wrong. The guy is obliged to marry his brother's widow. So, you know, this goes back and forth, all resolved in other ways anyway. But the point here is that these are rabbis, doctors in the ghetto, who have got friends on the outside, including one who's a friend of the Pope. Henry VIII is coming to the ghetto, so clearly there is interaction between the people in the ghetto and outside. Although, of course, you have to stress this only applies to very small elites, the intellectuals and the wealthy. The poor people in the ghetto, I think, have no contact with anybody except their own kind.
But it does convey that there is a lively intellectual life happening, and not only happening in the ghetto, but also that is famed outside it and across Europe in this case.
Absolutely. Another point I should make about all that, which is that Venice is the world's leading centre for the printing of Hebrew books. There's a man called Daniel Bomberg, who's not Jewish. He's a Belgian, comes from Antwerp. He moves to Venice. He sets up a printing shop and he gets a license to print Hebrew books. And he therefore has to employ Hebrew printers or Hebrew scholars who will look at the books, who will censor the books, because the church is very insistent that nothing can be published which might criticize Christianity. So he has Jewish scholars working in his printing press. He has Christians working in his printing press. They're all getting on very well together. It's an example of really harmonious cooperation between the two groups. This is why Venice, I think, establishes such a reputation, because books spread. Jewish scholars come from all over Europe to get their books printed, because suddenly we're at the dawn of printing here, and they're going back and they're talking about this remarkable cooperation in Venice. And Venice becomes the centre of Jewish life for the whole of Europe, even though they're confined in a ghetto. And in fact, horrible as it sounds, you're probably better off to be a Jew in Venice than anywhere else in Europe, because at least your life was controlled in some way. You couldn't be continually persecuting you. People weren't allowed to come into the ghetto and persecute you. There were guards on the gates. It was very different from if you were living, for example, in Germany or Poland.
That's so interesting. So what obviously is a constriction on their freedoms and is a form of control, nevertheless, actually, to some extent, you're suggesting acted as a form of protection.
And more than just a form of protection, I would say, you know, we know about the Enlightenment, and the Renaissance clearly is pre-Enlightenment. You know, the seeds are already being sown. The seeds are being sown in Venice for the Jewish Enlightenment, which is a little bit later than the general Enlightenment, and is usually regarded as being the start to that, is usually regarded as being in Berlin with Moses Mendelssohn in the 18th century. And what I would argue is that the Jewish Enlightenment is actually starting in Venice 150 years earlier with people like Leon of Modena. He's writing to scholars in England. John Selden, the great Talmudist and parliamentarian in England, quotes Leon of Modena in some of his works. So there's clearly an intellectual engagement, even if there's not a sort of physical engagement between ordinary people.
So tell me a bit more about some of the important figures of that cultural renaissance. You've mentioned now intellectuals, and you briefly mentioned poets, and there are musicians and artists and philosophers as well, aren't there?
There are all sorts, yeah. It's a very vibrant place. So the poet, Sara Kopia Sulam. Sara Sulam is, again, quite wealthy, but living in the ghetto, but obviously has some sort of a house, whether she has a whole house or just a floor, but she's got something. She starts a salon, a literary salon, and she gets people coming in from across Venice, Christians and Jews, into her literary salon. And that runs for a few years. She's regarded as one of Italy's leading poets of the early modern period. And she has a terrible time of it, because not only is she a woman, she's a Jew, and she's in the ghetto. She starts a correspondence with a friar in Genoa, a man called Cheba. And Cheba has written a poem based on the biblical book of Esther. And she's read this poem and she falls in love with the poem. And she writes to Cheba and says how wonderful it is and how she carries the poem with her everywhere. And Cheba responds and they have a correspondence. And gradually, Cheba, he's provoking her more and more. He tells her he wants to convert her to Christianity. He tells her he's in love with her, all this stuff. She has to remind him that she's married. He's celibate, but he's really trying it on with her. Members of her salon start to take advantage of her. She's accused by one of her best friends, another Christian friar, of denying the immortality of the soul, which means nothing to us, but was very big in those days. And she has to write a whole big response, you know, denying this. She is victimized because she's a woman, because she's a Jew. And yet at the same time, she's an outstanding poet and a remarkable personality. So you have her. You have Simone Luzzatto. He's 17th century. He's a philosopher. And he's living at the time when there's a debate going on in Europe about toleration, about can Christianity tolerate other religions, can Protestants tolerate Catholics, and so on. And he writes a book, The Discorso, The Discourse. The theme of the book is toleration of Jews in Venice, but it becomes used across Europe as one of the manifestos, if you like, one of the polemical works arguing in favour of toleration. Then you have Salomone Rossi. Now, Salomone Rossi is a court musician in Mantua, but he comes into Venice regularly, and he collaborates with Leon Modena, the man I told you about who has everybody coming to hear his sermons. Leon Modena is a polymath, and among his many skills, he's a singer. He's the singer in the synagogue, and he's concerned that the quality of singing and music in the synagogue services is very poor. So he and Rossi, over a period of years, collaborate on an operetta, if you like, which is basically a synagogue service, ends up being called Songs of Solomon. And they perform it on the Jewish festival, and people come in from all over Venice to hear it again, Christians and Jews all together in the same place in the synagogue to hear this. So you've got all this intellectual flourishing going on alongside the poverty and the misery of living in the ghetto.
As time goes on, the ghetto remains in place. In fact, it's there for almost three centuries. How does the treatment of Jews change over that period of time?
Well, there are really two main factors. One is just general modernisation. The status of Jews in Venice as people becomes better. The other is economic, because the Republic is really beginning to suffer and the Jews are still the body they can tax. So it ends up with Jews being given more and more privileges, probably being allowed out of the ghetto more frequently than we know, but we don't have any records of that. So their lives are probably better. But they are being forced to pay money to the Senate to maintain the Venetian economy. And the only way they can pay this money is by borrowing the money from the Venetian nobility. Venice is in a bind where it's taking money from the Jews, yet the Jews owe money to the individuals in Venice. They can't be too harsh on the Jews because they will lend the Jews money. You know, you might sit in the Senate and decree that the tax on the Jews is going to go up to this amount, and some of it is going to be your own money, which you want to get back. So you can't be too hard on the Jews or you won't get your money back. So gradually, things seem to improve. But of course, it's hard to tell because these are not things that get written down. This is interpersonal relationships, which don't really get written about.
That's really interesting in terms of the source material we have for this period. You know, how you access the experiences of these people is really crucial.
It is. I mean, Venice is really good at record keeping. One of the reasons why we know so much about the ghetto is the Venetians themselves are great record keepers, and there were diarists as well. But it is, in terms of sources, it is difficult.
I'm really struck also by the parallel between the way that governments today seem to judge immigrants on their perceived contribution to society, in the sense that actually any improvements or any amelioration in the treatment of Jews evolves out of a sense of their economic usefulness.
Yeah, and of course it starts with economic usefulness, but it ends up with you need immigrants to do the tasks that your own people won't do. And that's the situation we're in today. Whatever the government says, this country and most countries in the world have, you know, relied on immigrant labour for decades. That's why the Venetians decided to allow the Jews to stay. And the fact they're in a ghetto is a compromise between we need them, but we don't want them. And so we're going to put them in a place where we don't have to see them, but they're close at hand if we need them or when we need them.
So I want to ask you a question then to bring out fascinating conversation to a close, which is you've mentioned so many real notable figures emerging from the Jewish ghetto. So why is it that the most famous character among the Jewish Venetians is a fictional one, Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice?
I don't think that is to the detriment of the people who lived in the ghetto. I think that is to the credit of Shakespeare. What Shakespeare does is always going to be far more popular, far more well-known than what some guy living in 17th century Venice is going to do. But you're right. I think one of the reasons why Shylock is so famous, and you're right, Shakespeare has hundreds of wonderful characters, but Shylock is a bit different because we never know what to think of Shylock. Let me ask you a question. Is The Merchant of Venice an anti-Semitic play or a philo-Semitic play?
Well, that's precisely the thing about Shakespeare, isn't it? You can't
exactly.
say.
Exactly. And the only way you can sort of even approach that question is not to look at Venice and Shylock, but to look at Shakespeare and say, what does Shakespeare know about Jews? And what is the state of Jews in England when Shakespeare's writing? I mean, of course, Jews are banned from England, but there are a few. It's a fascinating subject. What I would say, though, is it seems very clear that Shakespeare didn't know about the ghetto, because he has Shylock living in a house which clearly can't be in the ghetto. And yet either Shylock is living in the 15th century, which seems unlikely, or if he's living in Shakespeare's time, Shakespeare doesn't know about the ghetto. And this is quite odd, because Shakespeare knows Sir Henry Wotton, for example, who is the English ambassador to Venice, who is a friend of Leo Medena, who is the guy I keep coming back to. So the circles of connection overlap. Maybe he does know about the ghetto and just decides to ignore it. But Shylock quite clearly doesn't live in the ghetto, and that I find very interesting.
Yes, it's almost as if Shakespeare is imagining an alternative universe, an alternative Venice in which Jewish people do just live amongst everybody else.
Exactly, yes. I mean, he meets Antonio in the street. Well, Jews do meet Christians in the street during the day, but the interaction between Shylock and Antonio suggests they are neighbours or live close by. It's fascinating.
Well, I like your question very much. That's one for us all to ponder and think about The Merchant of Venice and what he's actually trying to say.
I'll give my answer. It is not an anti-Semitic play. Whether it's philo-Semitic is something else, but it's certainly not anti-Semitic. That's my view.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for introducing us to this really crucial development in the treatment of Jewish people. You know, we all think of ghettos and what they come to be in later centuries, but it's so important to know about the origins and understand what was trying to be achieved by the Venetians and what the Jewish people managed to achieve despite them.
good way of putting it. There's a lot more in my book, Shylock's Venice, and you know, I loved writing that book because it just opened up so many new avenues for me. So, yeah, it was a great period in history if you live now and you're looking back on it.
And this book is highly recommended. So the full title, to remind everybody, is Shylock's Venice, The Remarkable History of Venice's Jews and the Ghetto. Harry Friedman, author of that book, thank you so much for coming on to Not Just the Tudors.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you ever so much.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit. And also to my researcher, Alice Smith, and my producer, Rob Weinberg. We are always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, @notjusttudors. And please remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.